All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming back. So today we're going to discuss something which is quite different from what we discussed yesterday. Namely, we're going to talk about a new approach to do principal component analysis with an eye towards robustness. And I put a question mark in the title because I don't claim to offer a definitive answer to the problem of robustly computing principal components. But I think it's a step in the right direction. Okay, so before I get started, I just want to mention that this is joint work with a graduate student of mine at Stanford, Xiaodong Li, and then two wonderful computer vision scientists, Ima and John Wright. Ima is at Microsoft Research Asia, and John Wright used to be there, but now is at Columbia. Okay, so I would like to motivate the problem by introducing a very simple problem. And then I'll tell you why I think it's an important problem. Okay, so my problem is, can we again try to work with the lights a bit? Okay, so my problem is very simply stated. What we have is we have a data matrix, M, which we're going to posit is a sum of two matrices. One has low rank and one is sparse. So pictorially, this is represented by something that looks like this. We've got a matrix which is available to the statistician or the scientist. And this matrix, we're going to assume that it's a sum of a low-rank matrix. And so from now on, L will stand for low-rank and S for sparse. So it's a sum of a low-rank matrix and a sparse matrix. The problem is that the low-rank component is not observed and the sparse component is not observed. I just get to see the sum of the two. And so the problem we'd like to pose is that, is it possible to recover the low-rank component and the sparse component accurately? And of course, it seems impossible because it's like a blind deconvolution problem where you write two numbers in your hand, A and B, and you show me the sum of A and B, and I see three, and how am I going to see, say, what is A and what is B? Perhaps A is one and B is two, or vice versa. It seems like it's an impossible problem. Yet I think that if we could find a solution to this problem, that'd be really great, and I'm going to try to explain why. So the motivation is coming from statistics today, and I'll begin with recalling what is classical principal component analysis. In principal component analysis, we have a data matrix M, and this data matrix, we really think of it as, you know, points lying in high dimensional space. So, you know, I've got this data matrix M. And when I look at a column of my matrix M, what I'm thinking of is that this is a vector in high dimensions. And so when we think about principal component analysis, what we think about is that these column vectors will be distributed near a low dimensional structure, right? So when I think about the columns and I represent them as points in high dimension, the goal of principal component analysis is, of course, to recover the low dimensional structure that is coming close to these high-dimensional vectors. So the setup is that we have a data matrix M, which is a sum of a low rank and a perturbation, just telling us that they are not completely on this plane, but near this plane. And so the principle introduced by Hotelling and Schmidt is to say, well, okay, so let's try to recover this inner structure. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to try to find a matrix which is as close as possible to the ones we observe, but it has a bounded rank, say, rank bounded by K. So now this constraint is really scary because an optimization problem with a rank constraint is really a scary thought. But this is the only scary optimization problem that we know how to solve. And the solution is, of course, given by the truncated singular value decomposition. That is, I can recover the low dimensional structure by computing the singular value decomposition of M and then retaining in the singular value decomposition only those terms corresponding to the k largest singular values. All right, so principal component analysis is a fundamental statistical tool. I mean, you cannot graduate as an undergrad from Stanford in statistics without learning about it, and it has, of course, had an enormous impact on applied science and engineering. One thing we teach a bit less to our students is that PCA is extremely sensitive to outliers. And so what I've tried to do is I've tried to represent this as a picture, or something which looks like this, where we've got data points, and they are indicated along this line. And as you can see, I can only draw in 2D, so I'm going to say, well, these data points are close to a smaller dimensional structure here, a line. And when I fit PCA, well, not surprisingly, I recover this line, which is very good. But suppose now there's this blue point, and this blue point has been incorrectly recorded, perhaps because of a man error, you know, when I entered the number in the computer, I made a mistake. And suppose now this blue point is over here, right? And so I rescaled everything, saying that this blue point, just because of, you know, a typo maybe, has come quite far away from the rest, and then I fit PCA again. Well, the first principal component will be given by this line, and so the direction you get has nothing to do with the underlying structure. And this illustrates what every statistician knows, which is that principal component can completely break down with even a single corruption in your whole data matrix. Okay, that's problematic because today we have to analyze data sets that are larger and larger in size. Data are increasingly massive, as you all know, high dimensional, and we need reliable tools to extract knowledge from such data, whether we talk about images, videos, web data, user data, and so on and so forth. And so the thing is that as you have these large data sets, the kind of gross errors that we've been discussing frequently occur in many, many applications. This is not something you can ignore. For example, because my colleagues work in computer vision, you know, you would like, for example, to design a face recognition software. And it is well known that, for example, if you look at the face of a person under various illumination conditions, will lie near a nine-dimensional plane. Okay, and this is called a nine-dimensional harmonic plane, and this may be found in this work. But the problem is that now you've got gross errors. You know, perhaps a person one day is wearing glasses. So you're going to have all kinds of occlusions. You're going to have occlusions of this kind. Perhaps the kind of data that you have to deal with is not perfect. It's not that it's a picture of Emmanuel in front of a whiteboard exactly at the right location, looking exactly at the camera and so on. And so because we have all these non-idealities, occlusions, missing data, sometimes you wear glasses, it is not true that it will project, that the original data set will project onto a low-dimensional space. And so we're going to have to deal with reality, which is of this kind. And so what we've got is we've got, because of occlusions in images, even though the uncorrupted data would be low-dimensional, because of the corruption, it is not. In bioinformatics, as you all know, sensors fail all the time, and so we get unreliable readings. In web data analysis, people actually mess up with data. Don't ask me why, but they do, and I'll give you an example of this, and so on and so forth. And so it's more and more important to make PCA robust vis-a-vis this kind of gross errors that can occur at many, many locations in your data matrix. Of course, the statistics community has thought hard about this, and there are many proposals to deal with outliers, and so I mentioned a few, but unfortunately, I don't have time to review those. Okay, all right, so this is, I hope, motivating our problem. The problem is, when I write down my model as having a low-rank component plus a sparse component, what I'm essentially thinking of is that, yes, the data is well approximated by low-dimensional structure, but there is corruption, which is captured by this sparse component. And now if I could actually reliably recover the low-rank term, then I might be able to do meaningful low-dimensional projections. Okay, so there's an obvious application is to make PCA robust. If we can perform this blind deconvolution, then I will find those data points that have been corrupted, and I'd be able to recover the low-dimensional structure. But there are other applications where the informative component may not be the low-end component. For example, it might be the sparse component. So here is a kind of an application that comes from computer vision, where a burning issue in computer vision is to separate foreground from background. So here you have a frame taken in an airport, and so, as you can imagine, you would like to have automated tools that can separate the airport from the people moving about the airport. Okay, And in a way, we can think about this as a low rank plus sparse problem, and here's why. So I have a movie now, so I have a sequence of frames, and what I can do is I can stack each image, each consecutive frame, as columns of a big data matrix. Okay. And now what I would say is, well, let's think about the background now. Well, of course, the background is not going to vary very much with time, so it's going to have extremely low rank. And so it really is the low rank component of this matrix. And then these people moving about the airport might be a sparse disturbance in this low background landscape. And so if I could perform the low rank plus sparse separation, I might separate automatically background from foreground, for example. Okay, so that's one application. Another application, and the reason why I started to work on this, has to do with Netflix. So I'm assuming that everybody knows about the Netflix price. Do we have people who do not know about the Netflix price? Oh, that's just great. Okay. All right, perfect. So the Netflix price, as you know, is you have to make predictions. So the Netflix price is a bit different than what we're discussing. The Netflix price is you see some entries in a matrix and you try to guess the many missing entries. Okay, and again, it's reasonable to assume that the Netflix matrix has low rank. In fact, if you look at the winning solution for the Netflix price, 75% of the solution is based on low rankness alone, and 25% on something else. Okay, so the problem is this, but then in a previous life, I worked on something called matrix completion, motivated by the Netflix price, and then I gave a talk, and someone told me, you know, your algorithm will not really work very well on Netflix because some people actually enter bogus ratings. And I don't know why they do this, but there are people who enter bogus ratings. And so what that means in the Netflix data set is that you have some entries in blue that are reliable and some entries in red that are not. And of course, nobody tells you what is reliable and what is not reliable. And so what you can think of this is you can think of as, again, a problem of the type we've seen, which is that you have a data matrix M, which is L, which is a true Netflix ratings, which is low rank, plus a sparse error, which corresponds to those data that have been tampered. And the problem here is like twofold. Not only you have corruption, but you see only a tiny subset. Okay, and so what you'd like to do is to try to recover all users' rating, which is what we would like to know, the low rank component, and S0 is, of course, the ratings that have been tampered with. So here you have a problem which is even more ambitious than robust PCA in the sense that you have both corruptions and missingness at the same time. Okay. The third application is extremely beautiful. It's due to Chandrasekharan, and I really like this way of thinking. So it's an application in graphical modeling now, where, well, we have what we call a Gaussian Markov random field. So this is a very fancy name for a very random vector X, which is normally distributed with mean zero and covariance matrix sigma. Now, the way people think about, you know, such vectors sometimes in the area of graphical modeling is via a graph. And so the way to think about this is what you look at is you have a relationship that says that x and x, two variables in these vectors, two coordinates in this vector, are conditional independent given everything else, if and only if the inverse covariance matrix, which is called the precision matrix, at location ij vanishes. Okay, so basically for Gaussian variables, this is a true statement. And so what you look at is you look at the inverse covariance matrix, and then you have places where it's zeros, which indicates conditional independence, and places where it's not zero, which indicates conditional dependence. And so what you can think about is you can try to represent this as a graph where you're going to put edges between two variables if and only if they're conditionally dependent, and no edge if they're conditionally independent. And people are typically, and more in high-dimensional statistics, interested in estimating such graphs, the conditional dependent structure. Okay, so now typically this graph might assume to be sparse, that is, you know, conditional on everything, for example, the you know, the price of a commodity depends, you know, conditioned on everything, depend only on very few things. And so we're going to have a situation like this. Okay. All right. And so there's a lot of work in statistics trying to, at the moment, trying to estimate covariance matrix under sparsity constraints on the inverse. But one thing is that you never know that you have actually measured all the variables. In fact, in many problems, you think you've got you've measured everything, but you have not. In fact, there are hidden variables that you could not measure, which are given by these white nodes. What you measure, perhaps, are these gray variables, but then there are variables that you have not measured. And so if you actually try to infer the graph structure without taking into account this unobserved variable, you're going to get completely wrong inference. And so the idea is, well, how can we get actually the conditional dependence along between the gray nodes when we do not see this part of the graph? So here is where this blinded convolution problem comes in. What you say is you have a model with observed and a few hidden variables. And so this Gaussian vector x, we're going to split it into xO for x observed and xH for x hidden. Here, the observed variables are the gray ones, the hidden variables are the white ones. Okay, so this is jointly normally distributed with mean zero and covariance sigma. Now, sigma has a block structure, which is you have the covariance of the observed variable, the covariance of the hidden variables, and the covariance between the observed and hidden variables. Of course, you can only observe this. You cannot observe this block, and this block. Similarly, we're going to write the inverse covariance matrix as in a block structure like this. Now, there's a very simple formula that, you know, called the Schur complement formula, if you will, from linear algebra that says the following, that the inverse covariance matrix of the observed variable is this block minus the so-called Schur complement, which is this. Okay. Now, here is really a piece of magic, because this I observe. Now, this matrix, which is observed, is a superposition of a sparse component, which is this, and a low-rank component, which is this, because the rank of this is at most the number of hidden variables, and let's say we have not forgotten too many. Maybe I forgot to measure the oil price. I'm interested in prices of airlines, and maybe I omitted the price of oil, for example. But suppose now I can perform this decomposition. Suppose I can perform blind deconvolution, that is, separate the sparse from the low-rank component. Then there's something magical that occurs, is that I can actually recover a portion of the graph, even though I don't get to see it. Okay, and that's a kind of a nice application of this sparse plus low-rank decomposition. Okay, there are many other applications in face recognition, system identification, a beautiful application in quantum state tomography due to David Gross. Really, really many applications of this low rank plus sparse model. Okay, so I'll split the lectures into two parts. First, I'll tell you some theory, and then I'll give you some numerics and examples. Okay, so the problem we have is very simply stated again. It's this deconvolution problem where we have a low rank plus sparse component, and I know nothing about each. I don't know the rank of the unknown component, low rank component. The sparse component, I don't know how many entries are corrupted. I have no idea where the matrix might have been corrupted. I have no idea about the magnitude of the corruption. I know nothing. To recover the low rank and the sparse component, we're going to use convex programming, just like yesterday. So I said that the theme of this lecture is really incomplete data and the unreasonable effectiveness of convex programming to deal with problems of this kind. And so the problem we're going to, the proposed solution is extraordinarily simple. What we're going to say is I'm going to try to make a guess of what is a low rank component and what is a sparse component. So we're going to try to find L and S so that the sum is, of course, what I observed. And among all these decompositions, and of course there are infinitely many, I'm going to pick one which has minimized a norm. So what is the norm? Well, we're going to try to minimize the nuclear norm of L plus a scalar times the one norm of S. All right, so I need to explain what these norms are. The first term is a nuclear norm of L. It's simply the sum of the singular values of the low rank matrix. The second term is I view S as a big vector, if you will, and I just take the one norm of this big vector, so it's a sum of the absolute values of this vector. Right? So the first norm is really a matrix norm because it has to do with the eigenvalues. It's not obvious that it's a norm, but it is. The sum of the singular values is a norm. And the second is really seeing S as a big vector, and it's a vector norm. And so what we're going to do is we're going to try to find an L plus S decomposition so that the nuclear norm of L plus a scalar times the one norm of S is minimum. It's very simple. It's a convex optimization program because we minimize the sum of two norms under equality constraint, linear equality constraints or affine constraints. And so it's a convex optimization program. In fact, it's a semi-definite program in disguise for those of you who know what is semi-definite programming. And the reason is that the nuclear norm has this SDP characterization. Okay. Now, the surprise is that under very broad conditions that I will try to explain, the solution to this optimization problem returns the low-rank component exactly and the sparse component exactly with no error whatsoever. Okay, so what are these conditions? Well, first of all, I need to give you a problem that makes sense. So, of course, if you give me a matrix M which is both low-rank and sparse, then how do I know what is a low-rank component and what is a sparse component? So if you give me a matrix that looks like this, I could say that L is this and S is 0, or I could say that L is 0 and S is this, or I could say that L is one half of this and S is the other half. Right? So this problem does not make a lot of sense, and so we cannot have a low-rank component that is a matrix M which is both low-rank and sparse, because otherwise this problem does not make much sense. And so what we're going to do is we're going to introduce a geometry condition which essentially tells us how the singular vectors, or the principal components, if you will, are aligned with the coordinate axis. It tells us something about the sparsity of the principal components. And so what we do not want to have is we do not want to have sparse principal components, because if we had sparse principal components, then we would get a matrix like this, and it would be a disaster. Or the disaster in the sense that the problem makes no sense. Okay, so a typical example of a matrix that we do not really want to see is this. So if I have a matrix whose first row is something and then everything else is zero, well, this matrix is both low rank and sparse, so what am I going to do? Okay, so we don't want to have matrices that look like this, and one way to say that we don't want matrices that look like this is we're going to impose some kind of condition on the column space and the row space of the matrix. Okay, so this is my technical slide. So what we're going to have is we're going to have a low-rank component. We're going to think about it via SVD. And so U is a basis for the column space. V is a basis for the row space, as everybody knows. And the rank of the low-rank component is R. Okay, so we're going to use a condition that has been used very successfully for matrix completion, and it says the following. It says that we're going to introduce a parameter mu, which essentially quantifies the correlation between the basis vector, that is the canon, the axis, and the column space and the row space. So mu is the smallest number we can find, such that when I take a basis vector EI, and I project it onto the column space, which is given by this picture. I take an axis, and I project it onto the column space. Right? The maximum norm I see is mu times the rank, that is the dimension of the column space, over the ambient dimension n. Okay? And the same thing for the row space. At this condition, we're going to forget it. Okay, so we're going to forget it. So, for example, if you had U and V, suppose that U and V are drawn at random, then if U and V are drawn at random, well, we know very precisely the energy that a vector puts on a random subspace is simply the dimension of the subspace divided by the ambient dimension. So for most subspaces, the mu parameter will be 1, or, you know, close to 1, and so it will be small. Okay, and so of course we're interested in subspaces for mu is not very large, because the other extreme is, an extreme is that where the subspace contains, because I don't have power, so my computer is going to sleep a lot. Okay. The other extreme is a situation in which a vector belongs to a subspace, in which case mu will be maximum because this is at some 1. So mu is between 1 and r over n. N over r, sorry. Mu is always between this. And we're interested in this, mu being small, because if mu is very large, it means that the column space and the row space are very, very close to the coordinate axis. In fact, they might even contain the coordinate axis, in which case you have a matrix that looks like this, and the problem makes no sense. Okay. All right. So this is a very geometric condition, and mu is measuring the correlation between the coordinate axis and the column and the row space. Okay, so we're going to assume that we have a matrix which is what we're going to call now incoherent. And I'm going to say, well, is the problem well posed now? Well, not quite. Because you can give me a very nice matrix which is incoherent, even of rank 1, for example. And so give me a beautiful rank 1 matrix with nicely spread principal components. But then I can corrupt it at will. So what am I going to do? Is I'm going to look at the first row, the first column of your low rank matrix, and I'm going to put it in S, and then I'm going to subtract it. So what I'm going to do when I'm going to do this is I'm going to zero out an entire column. When I do this, I do not increase the rank. If anything, I reduce it. And now, you know, now you will never know what was there. Because what was there is a linear combination of stuff like this, and like, which linear combination is it? You would never know. Okay? Right, so for example, imagine that you have a matrix of rank 1, which is then a dot product of the form, an outer product of the form XY transpose, right? The information about X1 is in the first column, everything else, the information about Y1 is in the first column. If the first column is erased, how can you know what is Y1? You will never know what it is. Okay, so what we're going to assume is that, well, if you're very devilish and you can actually corrupt strategic subsets of the data, then there's nothing I can do. And so, because we don't want to kind of discuss devilish actions like this, we're going to assume that, well, yes, we can corrupt adversarially, but the first thing we do is we're going to select a subset of entries, and then at random, and then you can do everything you do. You can do anything you do. Right, but the subset will be a fraction that you're going to corrupt will be selected at random. Okay, so these are the rules of the game. And the main result is, well, what I've just mentioned. All right, so we've got a sum L0 plus S0. We're going to try to recover it with this problem, you know. Then we're going to do something very strange. We're going to say that, well, we have to determine what is the value of lambda, and I'm going to say lambda is 1 over square root of dimension. Okay. So I solve this problem with lambda equals 1 over square root of dimension. It's not learned from data, it's not obtained by cross-validation, it's 1 over square root of dimension. So L0 is a rank, is a matrix. Let's say I'm going to state the theorem where the matrix is squared, but it holds for any kind of rectangular matrix. So let's say we have a low rank component, and its rank is quite high. It's actually a constant times n over log n squared. Right? So we're talking about very high rank here. So the condition on the rank is that the rank is, you know, the rank of the matrix is less than a constant times the ambient dimension divided by something that goes like log n squared. the number of corruptions is actually proportional to n squared. So it's actually, I don't know, like 10% of n squared, 10% of the data corrupted, which is an enormous fraction. And then we're going to solve this convex optimization program, this SVP, with the value of the balancing parameter lambda equals 1 over square root of dimension. And the theorem is that the solution is the exactly L0 and S hat is exactly S0. Right? So here's what it says. It says that, you know, you have a huge data matrix, which might be, I don't know, 10,000 by 10,000. Right? You've got in this 100 million entries, and of which 10% have been completely messed up. You have no idea which one. Okay, and what this optimization problem will do is will actually find exactly which entries have been corrupted and how, and so that you can recover underneath the low-end component. Okay, so this works whatever the magnitude of the low-end component is. It works whatever the magnitude of S0. I think what's a bit surprising about this is there's no tuning parameter whatsoever. Just you solve it with lambda equals 1 over square root of n. Okay, so this is a bit connected with matrix completion, which is a topic I happened to work on early on. Matrix completion is a simpler problem. It's simpler mathematically, and it's simpler. Matrix completion is this problem which is inspired by Netflix, where, you know, instead of having corruptions, you have missing data, and you'd like to know what's behind these question marks, right? So matrix completion, you observe a few data samples. There are many samples you do not get to see, and you'd like to guess what these are. Okay. And so you want to recover a low-rank matrix from a subset of its entries. Okay. And so in matrix completion, the prior art was as follows, which is that, well, you have many, many missing entries. So what you say is you try to interpolate and recover the missing entries. And in matrix completion, you do this by minimizing the nuclear norm. So you're trying to find a matrix which coincides with what you've seen and has minimum nuclear norm. Right? And there's a body of work, starting with the results that I obtained with Benjamin Resch, my former postdoc, that says that, well, when you do this, it works very, very well. Okay, and so we knew we could do matrix completion, but now this goes one step further and deals not with missingness, but with corruptions, which is harder. So in a matrix completion world, we have a picture that looks like this, right? You give me data, and I'm trying to guess the missing entries, but whenever I see a data point, I know it's good. Here, it's not more subtle because, you know, you give me a data point, and I don't know whether it's good or not. I don't know whether I can use it for the fit or not, and so I'm going to have to determine this. And so everybody working in error correction knows that it's much harder to detect and correct than just impute. This is the connection between those two. So when I say it's harder, I say it's harder in an information theoretic sense. So what we have here is we looked at the performance of this algorithm as a function of the rank of the low-rank component and the sparsity and the number of corrupted entries. And what we see is something some of you are familiar with compressed sensing. We see the same kind of diagram that we see in compressed sensing, which is that either the algorithm works all the time or it doesn't work. But there's no middle ground. There's a phase transition, a very sharp phase transition between the regime in which the algorithm works really well and the regime where it's not working. And this is given by this curve, roughly. And so what do we see on this plot? What we see on this plot, on the x-axis, we see the rank of the low-rank component as a fraction of n, and on the y-axis, we see the fraction of corrupted entries. So now, if I look at a point on this plot, let's say the rank is n over 10, and the corruption is 10%, so this is a point that would be right here. And what I see here is I see a white pixel. What does this mean? It means that when I run the algorithm 1,000 times with a rank equal to n over 10 and a corruption which is 10%, I was correct 1,000 times. I never failed. Now, if I'm in this region, is I was never correct. So white means I'm correct 100% of the time. Black means I'm correct 0% of the time. Gray means I'm correct 50% of the time. There are no gray pixels on these pictures. It's just white or black. And so what that is if you're in this region, you work extremely well. If you're in this region, you don't work. But the implication of the size of white region are quite amazing, which is that let's look at a matrix which has rank n over 20. Right, so it would be something like this. N over 20 is something that goes here. How many corruptions can I get and still recover a matrix of rank n over 20? Well, maybe 35%. So one out of every three term can be completely corrupted and doesn't matter. I can still recover this. Here is when you have missingness instead of corruptions. And here is the same plot, except that now here it's not the fraction of sparse, but the fraction of missing data. And then you can see this white region is much, much larger because it's much easier to impute than to actually correct, detect and correct. Okay. Right. So the point of this is that this works extremely well. I mean, now we've got data sets where n is 100,000, a million, and the rank, people would say, what do you believe the rank is? Well, it's 20, 25, 30, something like that. Right? So we're way, way, way close to this zero, and so the corruption can be extremely large. Okay, so there is another line of work that studied the same problem by Chandrasekharan, Shangavi, Parilo, and Wolski, except they have a completely different analysis of this. And what they do is they go through the notion of modulus of continuity. And so maybe I'll try to explain a bit of their work. And so it goes something like this. It's a deterministic analysis. We have a probabilistic analysis. The element of probability we require is that the locations of the corruptions are random. They have a deterministic analysis where what they're going to do is they're going to look at two moduli of continuity. So, and it's a bit technical. Okay, so what they have is that they consider the tangent space, that is, it's the span of all matrices with row space included that in that of L naught, or with column space included in that of L naught. So this is not super informative. So what you have to think about this is that you have the manifold of low rank matrices, and at L naught you take the tangent space. Right, that's his object. And then they define the modulus of continuity, which is I'm going to look at the maximum entry of a matrix that lives in this tangent space and has spectral norm less than 1. That's one element in the analysis. Then they do the same thing for the sparse component. That is, they look at the tangent space of the manifold of sparse matrices, which is easy to describe now. It's those matrices with the same support as F naught, and they define some kind of a dual modulus of continuity, which is that I say, now, what is the maximum spectral norm I can have if I'm in this tangent space and if the maximum entry is bounded by 1? And what the result says is that if the product of these two moduli of continuity, is less than 1 over 6, then this algorithm, for some lambda which is not specified, would work. So it's a very nice result because it offers a deterministic analysis of this. But the problem is that this is not super informative. So to kind of get concrete bounds, they move to our setup, where they're going to say, well, let's try to estimate these quantities in the setup that we consider. And so, well, what they get is something which is very different from what I've shown you, because in the setup we consider, what they can tolerate if the rank is high, for example. Suppose the rank is just like what we have, roughly n over log n or n over log n squared. The fraction of corrupted entries that they can tolerate is essentially 1 over n. And so it means that you have almost columns, entire columns that have not been touched, that have not corrupted. So we have a constant fraction of corruptions where for them the fraction is essentially 1 over n, so very, very few corruptions overall. Okay. So they are, but it's a powerful analysis because they have a deterministic result, which we do not have. Okay, and so the papers are very different, the models, the proofs, like everything is different, and also And we have a way of saying that, well, we should take lambda equals 1 over square root of dimension. Okay, so now, of course, this is a field that has attracted some attention, and I'm not sure you're seeing the sharpest result, because that's what I was telling some people about yesterday. That's what's so wonderful about this field, whether it's compressed sensing or matrix completion. There are so many young people who are so smart that they can get the best possible results. There's some beautiful results by Shu, Kakade, and Zhang, by Shangavi and Karamanis and their students, by my student on his own, Zhao Dongli. And, you know, it's possible that today we have better results. Okay. One of the papers, one of the things we do in our paper that the MIT paper does not do is that we can handle both missingness and corrupted entries, which is important in applications. And so in reality, what you're going to do is not only you're going to have corruptions, but you're going to have missing entries as well. And so here you just simply, you don't do anything. I mean, the recovery method is exactly the same. You say, well, you know, I'm going to try to minimize the same functional, but now the fit, I'm going to enforce it only where I have data. And when I don't have data, I just do nothing. Okay. And the result is exactly the same, which is that, well, I have now missing data and corrupted data. So the low-end component is as before. Suppose 90% of the data is missing, so I only see 10% of the entries in the matrix. And of that 10%, a constant fraction is corrupted. Then I solve the optimization problem with a value of lambda, which is 1 over square root of the fraction of observed entry times the dimension, and the low-end component is exact. So what you can do is you can correct what you've got and then interpolate with no error whatsoever. Okay. So you simultaneously complete and correct the matrix. All right. So what that means is that when you give me a few samples of a low-rank matrix and you have corrupted a few, I will know exactly which ones have been corrupted. And then, okay. All right. So these results are not easy to prove. I think they are delicate questions in probability theory. At least for me, they are delicate, and they are difficult to establish. So I cannot give you the proof techniques. I will just tell you that what it uses a lot of tools from Banach space theory, stuff that people like Ledoux and Talagrand and Milman and others have developed, and Bauguin have developed over the years. So it uses like concentration of measure, non-commutative Kinchin's inequality, a very beautiful result due to Mark Rudelson, which is called the Rudelson selection theorem, and so on and so forth. It also uses a technique that we had developed for matrix completion. And finally, I mentioned the work of David Gross, who actually simplified the proof for matrix completion by introducing a very powerful scheme, which he terms the golfing scheme, that plays a key role in the analysis of robust PCA. Okay, so there are some extensions. Of course, in reality, the data matrix you get to see is not low rank plus sparse, it's low rank plus sparse plus small noise. And so you'd say, well, can you deal with gross errors and small noise? And well, what you do is you change the program a little bit, the optimization, the objective functional is the same, but the constraints, you relax it. You just want that your low rank plus sparse fit is within the small noise level, and then you get an error, which is what you want. Okay, so you have stability, that is, you do not need exact low rankness and exact sparsity. You can deal with approximate low rankness, approximate sparsity, and you can deal with noise. Okay, and there are some strange things that, if the sparse components have random signs, then actually all the matrix can be corrupted and you can still recover the low rank structure. So it's a bit strange. Okay. All right. So perhaps in the second part, I will show you some quick numerics and then some kind of nice applications perhaps. Okay. So now we have to pay attention to computation. So we want to solve this semi-definite program. And if you use off-the-shelf SDP solvers, then you can go maybe to n equals 100, but you cannot really go beyond. And so what we have done is we have developed a simple and scalable algorithm via the alternating direction method of multipliers, which seems, in my view, Todd, to have been designed for this problem. Okay. All right. So we use ADMM. And so, we've implemented on very large data sets. And perhaps I'm going to not maybe go through this table, which tells you about performance and compute time. Maybe I will just run an example just to give you a sense of what's happening. Okay, so here's my example. What we're going to do is we're going to make a matrix which is 1,000 by 1,000. The low-rank component will be 45, so we're going to have a matrix of rank 45, which is 1,000 by 1,000, so we have 1,000,000 entries to call, and I'm going to mess up 100,000 of them. Okay, so the way I'm going to make my low-rank component is by, because I'm lazy, I'm going to take two random factors and multiply them together. Right, so I'm going to make a matrix which is 1,000 times 45 and multiply it by a matrix which is 45 by 1,000. Okay, and then I get a matrix, a random matrix, if you will, of rank 45. Then I'm going to select 100,000 out of the 1,000,000 entries in our data matrix by this command. The S0, the corruption, will be 0 except on the set I just selected. I'm going to set it to plus or minus 1. And then I'm going to show you the sum of the low-rank component and the sparse component. Okay, so when I execute this, it should run in MATLAB. And then I'm going to use this algorithm, this ADMM version. I think the only thing I want to notice is that everything takes place here. I'm going to try to recover L and S by running this algorithm, which you call RPCA, augmented Lagrangian. And all it takes as input is M, because lambda is 1 over square root of M. And then the step size are fixed in advance. It's not optimized in any way. And so let's do this. So what we see is we have an iterative algorithm. Okay, and we see that after a few iterations, at least on this example, it seems to lock in on the solution very, very quickly. Right, after a couple of iterations, the algorithm has discovered that the rank of L and S are currently the estimated rank of L, and the S is the estimated cardinality of the corruption. And we see that after 5 iterations, essentially it has found a matrix of rank 45, and it believes that there are 100,000 corruption, which is exactly correct. And then it's going to search for the truth. And it is an iterative algorithm. Like those of you who know ADMM, you know that it's an iterative algorithm that in this example terminates on a MacBook Air in 12 seconds. It's a MATLAB implementation. And so we need to see how well we do. So the relative error, so the rank of the truth of the true component was 45. The recovered rank is 45, and the relative error, so the relative error is the, it's here, is 1.8 10 to minus 6. So it recovered the low-rank component with 6 digits of accuracy. Okay, of course, the cardinality of the truth was 100,000. The recovered cardinality is 100,000, and so it seems to work well. Now, my wife, she's a statistician, and she's very doubtful about some of the stuff I do. And this is because the problem is so simple that anybody could do it. And so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to tell you, like, in the spirit of these comments, she designed an example which would be hard to solve. And I'll tell you what is her reasoning. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the sparse component and divide it by 100. And then I'm going to add the low rank plus. So now the size of the corruption is 100 times smaller than it used to be. Okay, so we're going to do this. Again, and then we're going to rerun the algorithm. Now we're going to rerun the algorithm. I'm not updating lambda in any way. Lambda is still 1 over square root of n. Okay, so we're going to rerun the algorithm. But before we do this, I want to show you why she thinks that it's a tough problem. She thinks that it's a tough problem because here is, you see the histogram of the entries of the low-rank component. So you see a bell curve with roughly standard deviation 0.01. And then she put exactly the corruption at 0.01, which is that, you know, it's going to be on amplitude alone. I can never tell that an entry is corrupted or not. It's not that the corruption is at infinity, right? So she has really embedded the corruption completely in the bulk of the size of the low-rank component. Now, I solve the same problem as it's what I've, I'm showing you. I'm solving the same problem with the same algorithm. I did not even change lambda, which is, I think, if you come from a stats department, it has to be surprising. You don't try to balance the two things. And so the algorithm is rerunning with essentially Kara scaling. But as you can see, we're already on the solution. Okay. And so the same algorithm with no tuning parameter is actually giving us essentially the same answer as before. It discovered that the rank of the truth is 45. The relative error is still something like 6 digits of accuracy, I believe. Or it's more now. It's 8 digits of accuracy for the thing. And so it doesn't matter. You know, you can rescale S now any way you like. Nothing changes because this is a parameter-free algorithm and you always get the truth under the condition of the theorem, obviously. Okay. So returning to the presentation, what we've got is we've got, you've seen a line that looks something like this. N is 1,000. The rank is what, 45 or 50, 100,000 corruptions. You always get the right answer. You get 6 digits of accuracy. I think I showed you 12 seconds, and you know, on average, it's 13 seconds or something like that. Okay. I think the point of this table is to show you that the cost of this algorithm is not much higher than PCA. If you can afford PCA, you're one order of if you can afford PCA, you're one order of magnitude away from the cost of this. Because this is essentially compute 20 principal component decompositions, roughly. Okay, so this is Kara's example. We don't need to go over this because we've seen it. Now let's look at some applications. Okay, so this is the application we talked about, and today my applications will be in computer vision because my colleagues work in computer vision. Okay, so these are some applications. As I said, you know, we want to separate low rank from background, and we're going to do this by simply searching for an L plus S decomposition, which, you know, has to be, okay. And when we do this, that is, we actually use L plus S with lambda equals 1 over square root of n, what we get is we get good results. So here are sequence, this is our, the data input, these are like consecutive frames in your video sequence. This is a low rank component, and then this is a sparse component. And we can see that it does a good job at finding, at separating the foreground, like these people which are showing up here, these people are showing up here, these three people are showing up here, from the background, which seems to be correctly captured. Now you'd ask me, well, why is this guy in the background? Well, this guy has not moved during the time of the video sequence. And as far as I know, it's a statue. And so it's part of the background. And it's correctly identified as background. What I want to emphasize here is that we're very far from the assumption of the theorem now, because as you can see, I cannot assume that the sparse component has randomly distributed occurrences. Okay. Here is a state-of-the-art method, which as you can see is getting confused about what is low rank and background. This is going to be more evident on the next experiment we did, where now you have a lobby. And now you can see that illumination is changing with time, like lights are turned off and on. And what we can do is we can see the low rank, and that seems to be like the lobby. And then the sparse disturbance is this person who just happened to walk, and then nothing else. On the other hand, I hope you can see well the kind of state-of-the-art method, you know, is getting confused about what is low rank and background, and you see a lot of the background and a lot of thinks noise occurring on the low rank frame. And so I think what I find a bit disturbing about this is that, you know, it's really brainless stuff. I mean, for example, we did not enforce that the low rank is positive, that because it's an image, so the background, well, it has positive intensity. We did not even put this in. And if we were, it would improve the result. We did not even put this in. And so already it gives a good result. Okay, so people are putting YouTube videos online. Okay, so this is like this thing running in almost real time. where you see people walking and then they show up in the sparse component and the low rank component, they're not showing. So let me show you, replay this video. So this is something we've done actually. This is some of our work where you see these people moving and then you see the low rank component, which is what you want. Okay, going back to the presentation, when we posted this video online, we were surprised to see that others were actually doing exactly L plus S, and so it's a way of validating your empirical findings because others reported similar results. So here's the work of others, exactly this L plus S decomposition applied to another data set, and they're more fancy than us, that is their resolution is higher. So let me show you in high res. Okay, so you see a lobby with people. This is a low-rank component. This is a sparse component. So you see people very clearly. There's no modeling assumption in this. There's nothing. Just low-rank plus sparse. And nothing else. And that's why it's extremely robust. It is when you throw this stuff at anything, it gives a reasonable answer because, I mean, you don't make any model. You just say, I'm going to try to find, decompose my data as a low-rank component, a sparse component. The low-rank component is what you want. It's a lobby. Sparse component are exactly these people moving about the airport. Okay, so the validation of this method offered by people, I believe they are in Australia, these folks. All right. Okay, so no modeling assumption. Nothing. Okay, so now... Well, it seems that one application of this is to repair old movies. So you, as you all know that old movies have these kind of speckles and these lines. And so you let them go through the L plus S decomposition and you're going to clean them up. So here's a frame in a movie and you can see that the corruption is here has disappeared. Here you have speckles and of course they are gone. They don't show up in the low rank because they're not consistent. You know, as you see these lines, they're going, you see these lines, they're going, the lines, they're going, you have like spots, speckles, they disappear, and so on and so forth, right? So here, I don't think you'd have to do much tuning of lambda. I mean, for all the numerics that you're going to see, lambda was in between 1 over 10 of the square root of n, or the smallest, the maximum dimension, and 10 over square root of n, right? Something like that. If, of course, you take lambda to be too small, then Tom Cruise will disappear. And that's not good. Okay. All right. Of course, you can apply this to faces to correct, you know, what makes, as I mentioned, face recognition difficult is you're under unideal conditions. And so you've got, you know, specular points in the eye. You've got strong shadows. You've got like the camera is saturating over here, and so you've got all problems that will make recognition difficult, but you can clean this with low rank plus sparse because all the kind of the bad things will be put in the sparse component, which is from now on called E for error. Okay, all right, and so you know you have the specularity points that are showing in the sparse component, the shadows, and so on and so forth. Now I'm going to show you work which is not mine anymore. It's work of Ima and his colleagues at Microsoft Research. And I'm just going to show it to you for fun. Do we have 5 minutes to show this stuff? Okay. So when I say that, you know, if you work in computer vision, do you see this low rank plus sparse model? Not quite. Because we're going to have low rank structure if images have been aligned. And so you see them only if they're alignment. And so the idea of Ima and his colleagues is to say, let's try to find an alignment tau so that after alignment, I'm low rank plus sparse. I exhibit this low rank plus sparse structure. And tau will be very parametric. You know, it's an affine or a rigid transformation, something very simple. And how do you find tau? Well, you do joint optimization. That is, you're going to try to minimize the same cost function subject to after deformation. You know, you fit the data. And you'd say, well, is this convex? And no, it's not. And so you find a local minimum of that stuff. Okay. So here is something that really, I think, tells what I want to say, which is that now you've got pictures of a building, and you see the angle is changing, right, from one frame to the next. Of course, you have occlusions. You have these trees showing up in the building. And so what is the algorithm doing? It's going to try to find a parametric transformation and a low rank and sparse component. So this is how it aligns the data, by trying to find the low rank plus sparse structure. This is a low rank component, and this is a sparse component. So it completely separates the building from the occlusion in front of it. Completely. Suppose you have pictures of people like this, and you want to align them because you want to do face recognition, perhaps. And some pictures have been rotated, and also they've been occluded. So for example, if you see carefully, you see this guy has a stamp on his eye, and this guy has two, and this guy has one, and this guy has one. And so if you were trying to find, you know, eyes as cues to actually do face recognition, it would be problematic, because if you look for an eye and there is none. Okay, then you apply this idea of trying to find a parametric transformation so that after transformation you're as low rank plus sparse as possible. And what you get is, first of all, you get aligned images, still corrupted, but when, of course, when you take the low rank component, then you remove the corruption and the corruption shows up in the sparse term. This picture, I mean, okay, so I'll show you what this is. Apparently, I've seen the guy who is on the picture. He says this experiment is valid. Okay, so here is what it is, because to me it's too good to be true, honestly, but apparently it's valid, and I believe it's valid. Here we have like images of a person, as you can see, under extremely different conditions. This person is wearing sunglasses, has a shawl in front of his mouth. He's wearing a wig here, a hat. He's shouting. He has a hand in front of his mouth. He's seeing strong shadows and so on. Okay? Then you apply this idea of low rank plus sparse. Now, what is a low rank component? It's this. What is a sparse component? It's this. So there's a one-to-one correspondence. So this guy has been mapped into this. That is, you remove the sunglasses and you put the eyes instead. Here you remove the hat, and you know it's showing at the forehead. Here you remove the shawl and you put the mouse. Here you remove the wig, and all of this, of course, show up here. And now I say, well, can I recognizing this guy was very hard, because I'm going to look for the eyes and it's very difficult. But can I recognize this person? Yeah, it doesn't seem to be too complicated. So it seems to me that as a pre-processing step, before you feed stuff to a recognition algorithm, this might be a useful thing. Okay. So this is where you go on the internet, you collect images about famous people, and then you do averaging. And so if you average before alignment and repairing, but if you do not correct for occlusions and so on, you know, you get very rough things. But if you actually do the algorithm I just presented before you do averaging, then over all of a sudden things come in focus and you can recognize these people. Okay. You can use this to pre-process handwritten digits for classification. You know, the reason why hand-digit classification is difficult is because people write the number 3 a bit funny, for example. But then you can say, can I actually rectify it using these methods? And yes, you're going to find a parametric transformation, so you have low rank plus sparse. And what it does, it maps this table of 3 into that one, and you can see that it has transformed this 3 into this, which should be now fairly easy to recognize. Okay. So they work for Microsoft, so they work on lots of strange projects. Maybe I'll try to... So the word that we see is tilted, and they try to untilt it. Okay. And so the idea is, now I'm going to present to you a texture, and this texture might be low rank because it's periodic, so it repeats, so you have high correlations, but you may have you want to be robust, so you may have, you know, you want to be immune to corruptions or occlusions, things like that. Right? And so now what you're going to do is, on a single image, you're going to try to rectify this texture on a single image. And so, of course, what you're looking for is, you're looking for textures that look like Cartesian grids, because that's what low rank structure likes. Okay, the idea is, if you have a texture that looks like this, after transformation it's going to look like this. This is a low rank matrix plus perhaps a sparse perturbation, and so eventually you will undo this this distortion. Okay, so they've applied this onto many, many data sets, and they get results that, again, are strange, so that you can actually rectify something like this is not very difficult to understand. So you see this checkerboard at an angle, and of course, after the algorithm is done, it's tilted back so that it's at the right angle. And of course, it's obvious why, because this matrix has rank. Seen as a matrix, the rank of this is 2, right? So that's what you like. Right, so again, this is obvious why you would want to do something like this, because you see a piece of texture that looks like this, then the algorithm will put it back so that you find a rank 1 matrix. If you see something like this, you'll straighten it to find a rank 2 matrix, and so on and so forth. What's a bit strange to me is that now they go out and they take pictures of signs that they find in parks, and so these are taken at an orientation where the algorithm, it put them straight. You know, if you take a piece of text, it's going to be aligned. If you put a barcode, it's going to be aligned. If you put a Chinese character, it aligns them. If you put towers like this, it may not be a good idea. So it does a lot of alignment. Okay, and so you can also do this on buildings to actually find 3D structures from just 2D photographs. And so IMA has launched a huge activity in this where, you know, if I know how to align, then it means that I know the 3D structure. And so what they found is that they can actually find 3D structure from 2D photographs. And if they know how to recover 3D structure from 2D photographs, then they can augment reality and stuff, do stuff that Microsoft cares about. Okay, so they have a lot of spectacular experiments where, you know, you show them, just by looking for low rank plus spots, you show them pictures, and they will say, here's the 3D structure of the building, just by these techniques. Okay, so I'll conclude and say that what I presented is a principled approach to robust PCA that seems to work well in theory and in practice. Lots of people are working on scalable algorithms for problems that have millions, if not billions, of unknowns. I think there are many applications of this low-rank plus sparse decomposition. I've shown you a few, but I think there are many more to come. And if you are interested in this topic, we wrote a paper in JICM that was published last year. Thank you very much.